de ontem de noite.
Diz, Zé Paulo.
Ó, Samael.
O que é que tu queres, Zé Paulo?
Anda aqui para a cama. Ó, Zabelito. Largando ela. Anda aqui para a cama, para a minha beira.
Ó, Zé Paulo, tem calma que eu já vou.
Anda a casa, vai.
Mãe, papai.
Ó, Zabelito, anda aqui para a cama, já são 10 horas. A minha mais novela. Ó, Zabelito. Zabelita. Abraça-te a mim.
Ó, Zé Paulo. Tu rapaz das costas.
Concerto de abertura solene das aulas da Universidade de Coimbra. O álbum de estreia do LUME, Lisbon Underground Music Ensemble, tem lançamento marcado para o dia 15 de setembro pelas 21h30 no TAGV. Um evento com o apoio RUC. Liberta o demónio que há em ti. Alguns minutos para lá das 10 da noite neste sábado, dia 11 de setembro. Uma data infame por vários motivos e, como não podia deixar de ser, também em preto no branco se fala do 11 de setembro de 2001. Em preto no branco não deixamos passar essa efeméride em claro. A emissão de hoje traz-nos excertos de dois podcasts, ambos responsabilidade do site visibility911.com. Este é, de resto, o podcast que há mais tempo se vem debruçando sobre as questões ainda por averiguar relativas ao 11 de setembro de 2001. Por aqui, na primeira e na segunda hora, vamos ter excertos, então, de dois podcasts do visibility911.com. São, de resto, duas entrevistas conduzidas por John Bursell, não o fundador, mas um dos membros mais ativos na realização de podcasts para o visibility911.com. Primeira entrevista com Ken Jenkins, um engenheiro de formação, mas com uma atividade constante em outras áreas, nomeadamente na área da realização, mas também na escrita, sendo também um ativista bastante conhecido nestas questões da verdade acerca do 11 de setembro. Na segunda metade, o entrevistado será Kyle Hans, também ele um conhecido ativista pela verdade acerca do 11 de setembro. Foi o fundador do site 9/11 Citizens Watch e mais recentemente foi também produtor de um documentário, 9/11 Press for Truth. São então duas entrevistas com um dos colaboradores permanentes do podcast Visibility 9/11. Podem descarregar os arquivos deste podcast em visibility911.com. É, de resto, um podcast interessado na verdade e não apenas nas teorias da conspiração. Prova disso mesmo será o grande número de entrevistas com investigadores do outro lado da barreira, por assim dizer. Aqueles que aceitam a versão oficial dos factos. Ficam então na emissão de hoje os dois excertos de podcasts do visibility911.com no dia em que passam 9 anos sobre os ataques do 11 de setembro em Nova Iorque. Deixa-se ficar desse lado com a RUC, preto no branco, até bem perto da meia-noite.
Confronting the evidence,
back to another episode of Visibility 911. I'm your host, John Bursell, currently filling in for Michael while he has a rest. And today I'm very excited about having a good friend and someone that I think sees things very clearly in the 911 truth world, Ken Jenkins. Now, Ken Jenkins, many of you probably know who he is. He's probably most famous for the films that he's produced with 911TV.org. And recently he's been working with Richard Gage. And also he's worked in the past with David Ray Griffin and many other people. And he's also facilitated filming at a couple of conferences I've been involved with. And he's been pretty much all around the world with 911 Truth. Now, before we move on to Ken, I just want to send out a message to everyone out there again that we're Visibility 911. We are looking for some donations at the moment to help fund our net hosting, the podcast hosting, and all the other expenses that come with running the program. If you'd go to the visibility911.com website, you'll find the information there that you need to contribute, and that would be greatly appreciated by all the team here at Visibility 911, Michael, myself, Scott Ford, and the other people that assist. Now, Ken... It's great to have you on the program. I don't think you've been on Visibility 911 before, is that right?
No, I've not been on this particular one.
Okay.
And great to be talking with you again, John.
Lots of other radio shows, but not on the Visibility 911 program.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your long and very interesting journey in the 911 truth movement?
Okay, sure. Well, I started very early on. It was just like a week or two after 9/11 that I started getting some information by email that countered the official story. And I had kind of had a few doubts even on the day, kind of wondering where the heck were the fighter jets sort of thing. And so I just kept reading the stuff that was sent to me, and then I started looking on my own. And about 2 months later, I was fully convinced that the official story couldn't be right. And that was long before we had all the information on the demolitions and that sort of stuff. So it was more based on the stand down of the Air Force and the put options on the stocks and all the other early information. So once I was fully convinced, it was like, well, what do I do about it? Well, I'm a filmmaker. I guess I'll make a film, but that takes time and money, and I got neither. So I just started putting together, actually I taught myself PowerPoint so I could put together a presentation to start spreading this beyond my personal friends. And by early 2002, I was doing public presentations using the PowerPoint and video clips that I put together. Particularly looking at the historical comparisons to other events that have happened, other false flags and so forth, and particularly for me, Pearl Harbor, because that was the thing that really I didn't know anything about but the official story before 9/11, and that was the one that really kind of put me over the top and got me fully convinced about 9/11, because it was also a very big operation and it was covered up for a very long time. So then eventually I met Carol Burle, and she came to one of my early presentations and started working with her and helped her form the local group. And, of course, we've been doing many events here in the Bay Area since, including the first major conference in 2004, March of 2004. And at that conference, we had many good speakers speaking on many aspects of the evidence, and that was so well covered that I didn't want to be redundant as a speaker, so I chose to speak more on the psychological aspects of that 9/11 was a psyop, and that there are psychological blockages to people wanting to even look at the evidence. And that's kind of been one of my little niches ever since, is talking about that angle on it. And as you know, John, I have an article out now that's in the last issue of Global Outlook, also posted at 911truth.org. which is titled "The Truth Is Not Enough," and so if you want to get the essence of what I have to say about that, it's all in that one article. And then, as you said, been kind of around part of the world anyway, speaking as well as this country, and my main topic is always the psychological aspects. But as you mentioned, my main work actually is in video and producing with 911 TV. Not only many DVDs from these various conferences, but all the major releases from David Ray Griffin and more recently with Richard Gage and AE 911 Truth, of which I'm a member because my degree is in electrical engineering. So, And that kind of brings us a little more up to the present in terms of the recent work with AE and the press conference from just a few months ago, as we passed 1,000 signatories to the petition by architects and engineers. And that will be available very shortly as the DVD of that presentation, which, of course, is up on the web. Tens of thousands of people have seen it now on the web. And we can talk a little more about what's coming up maybe at the end of the show. We got a new one coming up with firefighters as well as AE.
Yeah, no, I heard a little bit about that off Eric the other week, the last podcast I did with Eric Lawyer, and I've heard that he really impressed yourself and Humuk and the 911TV.org crew down there at the press conference. Very impressive speaker, real stand-up guy, and there's a great hope that the organisation of firefighters for 911 Truth with architects and engineers for 911 Truth will become a force that's too hard, I suppose, to resist for the public. Let's hope.
Yeah, I quite agree. We were, as you say, quite impressed by Eric Lawyer and his presentation. It's very well spoken and had a good way of telling his story and the firefighters' story. And as you say, the combination of the architects and engineers with the firefighters makes a real kind of compelling view of the evidence for demolitions.
Yeah, it's sort of the academics and the working man coming together, really, in a real sense. But Eric's quite well educated himself. And I'll just remind everybody, if you didn't hear last week's show, there are T-shirts available at the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth website that support the first responders. They're great T-shirts, and please consider buying one of those. If you've got some spare cash, get a Firefighters for 9/11 T-shirt. Anyway, we'll move on from the story of Ken, and we'll come back to that a little bit more at the end. Like you said, we'll talk about the new production coming up next month, and hopefully we'll be available for distribution approaching the anniversary of 9/11 this year. Now, today's program I've titled Staying Reasonable with 9/11 Truth, A Powerful Path to Success. Now, I sort of got that last bit from saying that you've always said 9/11 Truth, a powerful path to peace, Ken, so I sort of jumped on your saying there a little bit. But first of all, do you agree with that statement? Do you think that staying reasonable with 9/11 Truth is the way to success for this movement?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is that the topic we're trying to introduce people to, the alternative story of 9/11, is so emotionally challenging to people that the more kind of reasonable and kind of cool, calm, and collected we can stay in terms of not only our demeanor, how we present ourselves, but also with the specific kinds of information that we present, the more likely people are going to stand still long enough to listen without just running screaming the other direction, so to speak, because it's quite many of us that have been in the movement for a long time forget how difficult this information is to absorb at first. It's just so much of a paradigm shift, such a shift in worldview. And another major thing is that the implications of it are just so uncomfortable, disturbing, that if 9/11 was an inside job or something other than the official story, then it implies a whole lot of other uncomfortable things that not everybody is fully familiar with, like, you know, the corruption and the compliance of the media, and that there are people in powerful positions that would do something this horrendous. It's hard for people, and so for us as activists to remain calm, cool, collected, reasonable, as you put it, I think is very important to our success.
Well, that's great to hear. I sort of thought you were going to say that, but I didn't know for certain. But, yeah, that's really something that the Visibility 9/11 podcast has been really pushing, and I've been pushing that idea since I started with the show at the beginning of the year, is that being reasonable and taking a peaceful approach to things and being firm with our message, but definitely, trying to find the evidence that is undeniable, the evidence that's clear, the evidence that really has not been contested successfully anywhere by academia or in the media is really the way to success. Now, looking back over the many years, you've been working for the cause right back to 2002 and the first conference, and you've seen many, many conferences since. You've seen groups come and go. You've seen groups that have been around for a long time that have maybe gone the wrong path, other groups that have stuck to their guns and sort of stuck to a simple message. Who do you think has been the most successful and why, and also what do you think the strategies that have been proven over the period that you've been observing?
Well, the second one's a really big question, but let me start with the first. I think one way to illustrate what works versus what doesn't is what happened with the one of the very first major groups, the Scholars for 9/11 Truth, where when that was originally founded, all sorts of scholars from all sorts of fields jumped in and formed this group, trying to get work with the more rational, provable kind of information and the more scientific information and so forth. And that went well, okay, for a while until a few members in that group, and most specifically Jim Fetzer, decided to kind of play more with what we sometimes call exotic theories, so less proven, kind of more sort of interesting and intriguing, but not necessarily grounded in reality theories. And at that point, other scholars in that group felt very uncomfortable with that approach, and it ended up splitting the group into two parts. And now we have Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, with most of the scientists and engineers who kind of all jumped ship simultaneously and ended up in that new group. And then this smaller kind of fringe element staying with Jim Fetzer with Scholars for Truth. And that, in a sense, kind of illustrates the two different things and what works and what doesn't, because, you know, the truth is the vast majority of scientists, engineers, and so forth did choose to stay with the more rational science and chose not to spend too much time and certainly not publicly endorsing the more exotic theories, which many of us in the movement feel actually beyond counterproductive, really kind of destructive potentially. You can imagine, as difficult as the 9/11 truth message is to newcomers, that if you approach them with something like, well, no planes hit the towers, it's just so absurdly outlandish that you just lose people immediately. Even if it was true, and this is the point, even if it was true that somehow some kind of exotic holograms or whatever video effects were used to simulate plane collisions, it would still be one of the most foolish approaches to bring that information to newcomers or even people that are fairly fresh to this idea, because it just seems so unreasonable and it will push people away. So I think we have to be strategically very, very careful in terms of what we present publicly, what we present at our websites, what we put into videos, and so forth, and keep things, as you say, reasonable, kind of down to earth and amongst the most solid and provable and indisputable of all the information, so that when we do approach the newcomers, which is always our biggest challenge and our main kind of focus and effort is bringing more people around to this point of view, that it is reasonable and it doesn't just push people away because of an outlandish sort of approach.
Yeah, it was interesting watching the video coming out of the Treason in America conference, listening to the people that heard the planes and saw the planes on 9/11. How must they feel when people suggest that the planes don't even exist, even not sort of thinking about the public, but thinking about the victims and the first responders and the people who were there? You know, the lack of respect that's shown by that theory without evidence, in my opinion, and definitely without clear evidence, I'd say, in most people's opinion, is really beyond damaging. It's destructive. It is clearly destructive to the movement. But anyway, yeah, that's all true. So, you know, would you say that the story of architects and engineers would be one that we could put forward as a clear success in the movement?
Well, I certainly think so, John, and it's kind of proven to be that way, both within the movement and outside the movement, that the professional approach with a professional group like architects and engineers, and they kind of stand out as one of the main leaders at this point, it gives a certain validity, a certain solidness, a certain kind of officialness, a solidness to the information that is ultimately undisputable. I mean, there really have been no effective debates or disputes to the information presented by the architects and engineers, and as you say, it's kind of a a way to look at our approach as, well, this works, and this is a kind of an approach that we can reach not only more and more just regular citizens and people, which is always important, but also reaching more into government officials. I think the effort in New York City right now with the city council is an example where they're looking even in an even more focused way, even than architects and engineers, just at Building 7 and just saying, look, this, the fall of this building needs to be investigated. That's all we're saying. We're not espousing any theories. We're not, you know, suggesting anything other than this building's destruction needs to be investigated. And that kind of a very narrow focused approach on the most solid and indisputable parts of our evidence can open doors that any kind of that other approaches just haven't been as effective at. So I think the architects and engineers and even going a step beyond to this new approach in New York is showing us methods that can work better than other methods we've tried in the past.
Well, they're methods that are proven in the world of politics. I mean, to narrow the focus often broadens the influence, and that's exactly what you've pointed out then. And I'd like to say that, you know, Chris, I think it's Gruner, is that how you say his name? And the team
are
putting forward this, you know, I suppose it's... it's like a blitzkrieg on the council there in New York City. It's a great idea. It's a focused campaign. It's one that's simple. They're not being conspiratorial. They're simply putting forward some evidence that needs to be investigated. And as you say, it's a very powerful way of approaching the subject of 9/11 truth. And I think it's come off the back of architects and engineers, just like we're seeing new material coming through the Journal of 9/11 Studies that I think has been enhanced by the sort of cooperation they've got with architects and engineers. Have you seen the latest paper? I plan on doing a show on it in the next few weeks called The Falsifiability and the NIST WTC Report, A Study in Theoretical Adequacy. Yeah, that's a very interesting paper that's been put forward by someone anonymous, and Dr. Frank Legg has then sort of, you know, gone over it and then joined in with the paper. But I often wonder who this anonymous person is, and I know there's many other people that are now considering joining the 9/11 Truth Movement, and from the calibre of this article, if people want to read that, that's at the Journal. It's 20 pages long. It's extremely interesting, and it pulls apart the official arguments, you know, coming out of NIST, and just completely proves that there's no theoretical adequacy to the 9/11 report that we've been told about. And I see this sort of this joining together of numerous groups now, also the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth and other very reputable groups now that are starting to trust each other. And that trust is built on the fact that they're not being conspiratorial, they're being factual, they're being clear in their mission of simply, you know, demanding a new criminal investigation. And I think that's working really well for the movement. What would you have to say about that, Ken?
Well, I just totally agree. There's actually not much I can add. I'm not as familiar with the newest article, but this very narrow the action in New York with Building 7, it is backed up. It is supported by architects and engineers. And so that if people are willing to take a look and if they are interested, you immediately have all this knowledge behind the request for a new investigation.
Yes, that's right. Now, I'll just move on to the next question before we have a brief break. Now, this gets a little bit more difficult to sort of point out things that haven't worked for the 9/11 Truth Movement, but I think it's an important thing, and it's something that the program here, Visibility 9/11, has been prepared to do from time to time in the interests of the movement, not always very popular. But I'd just like to ask you what you think have been the most marginalizing things that have happened in the movement. You know, recently we've seen some people sort of coming forward with arguments about who did 9/11. And we'll broach that topic after the break. I know that you've got a theory that's symbiosis, I think, is the term that's used. Others want to finger in individual groups or certain racial groups, which, you know, I don't think is particularly good. Because if I look at Wikipedia's reference about 9/11 truth, the first thing they say is that, you know, the first argument was brought forward that there was no Jews killed on 9/11 and it was a Mossad operation. And we see that as one of the reoccurring themes that has been used to marginalise us as racists or as as anti-Semites. There's other things that have been used to marginalise us, in my view, which is the exotic theories that you talked about. Would you like to sort of maybe go through, I don't know if you want to list them, but if you want to go through a few particular instances that are that demonstrate how we can be marginalised by certain sections of the truth movement?
Well, certainly the exotic theories is something we can talk a little more about it. But before even going into that, what I would like to point out is what I've seen is, if I were to say one thing that's been the most destructive in all the, 9 years or whatever I've been involved with this, it's the infighting. It's the marginalization of each other from within. It's the accusations which continue to this day between individuals or groups that where if they don't agree on some part of the information or some approach, that all too quickly, in some cases, fortunately not all, but in all too many cases, people are so quick to accuse the other person of working for the other side. Oh, you're COINTELPRO, or you're this, or you're that. And you see it from some of our best people even at times, but certainly it's been all too pervasive. Now, on the one hand, it's understandable because those of us that date back to the 60s or in the 70s with the anti-war movement and so forth, we now know for an absolute fact that COINTELPRO did invade the various peace groups, and they did have agent provocateurs, and they did do great harm and destruction to those movements by creating infighting and by creating provocative acts, sometimes even violent, that would turn the public against the movement and would divide the people within the movement and make them sort of suspicious of one another and so forth. So that's the history we all come into this with. Well, unfortunately, what's kind of happened, see, part of the reason those were successful, the various agent provocateur and various invasions that were done under the COINTELPRO movement, part of the reason they were as successful as they were back then is that people were a little naive, they were a little too trusting, and so that they were able to be infiltrated in that way. But now we see the opposite problem. The pendulum has swung too far the other direction, where people are so suspicious and so willing to, you know, to label each other as COINTELPRO type infiltrators just because they disagree with them on some factual information or some strategic approach. And so we have become our own worst enemies in this movement. And it's been that way right from the beginning, and I say partly because of this historical context, but partly because it's kind of one of those emotionally stilted shortcuts that all of us can tend to do wanting to be right and wanting to make our point and wanting to win our arguments and are willing to say terrible things about our fellow activists. And John, you and I have talked, for instance, Kevin Barrett, who was here recently, and Kevin's a good friend of mine. I respect him a lot, and yet at the same time, I've seen him make statements and then people that oppose him making statements about him, again, accusing them of terrible things, of kind of working for the other side, so to speak, and being COINTELPRO kinds of agents. And it's just not so. I mean, it's just like we haven't really caught a single person red-handed where we can say for certain that was true, and yet it goes on. So that would be my primary message in terms of, you know, what not to do is, you know, not to accuse other people without absolutely substantial evidence, of which so far there's been essentially none, and to give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, don't play the man or the woman, you know, play the evidence. Now, you know, in the case of Kevin Barrett, I've been outspoken against Kevin Barrett, especially recently over his attack against 9/11 blogger and 9/11truth.org, which, you know, he doesn't really get a hearing at anymore because there's been too many problems over the years due to the controversial nature of Kevin's approach and also due to the, you know, provocative people and topics that he wishes to talk about, which is his right. There's no doubt about that. But obviously, an organisation like 911truth.org is an organisation that represents 911 Truth. Now, it's a little bit different when you're an individual, you know, and you've got the, you know, got the American Constitution behind your right to free speech, etc., and you're just out there doing a radio show. A little bit different to someone and a group, you know, editor being Janice Matthews and obviously the board behind 911truth.org. They don't necessarily want to put up every outrageous statement made by someone up at that website, because the public go there and they judge us on what's at the website. Now, you know, being a news organisation, that's a different thing. Now, I don't consider 911truth .org a news organisation as such. You know, I know we lack proper news coverage in the world today, and that's why there's a lot of pressure put on websites to put forward, you know, all the sort of news going down at the moment. And you know, we'll talk a little bit more late, a little bit more later after the break about the Alan Sabrowski, you know, assertions. About who did 9/11, and you know, and Kevin sort of, you know, fingering these groups, not just individuals but whole organisations that work tirelessly for the cause of 9/11, including 9/11 Blogger, which is really the place that most of us get our news from. What the point is in saying that those organisations might be owned by, you know, our opposition or the enemy or Mossad or whoever it might be, it just, to me, just is insane. So, you know, that's why some of it's
certainly highly counterproductive. Absolutely.
I shouldn't say insane, because that's one of those things that we throw around that we shouldn't throw around, but highly counterproductive. And that's why people get drawn into, you know, these personal arguments with people in the movement. But anyway, it's a terrible shame. But thanks for bringing that point up, because that is one of the things that's very destructive. And I do think we are paranoid about, you know, people in the movement doing things for reasons that we imagine. And the real reasons could be much simpler, simply to do with their personalities and or their, you know, their way of thinking about things.
Exactly.
Anyway, there's a few other things that I wouldn't mind quickly broaching with you. Now, with the group Pilots for 9/11 Truth, obviously some very esteemed and great members of that organisation, including Bob Bowman, you know, he's a doctor of architecture, so aeronautics and nuclear physics, and also a pilot of many years, you know, that I'm good friends with and I talk to on the phone from time to time. He's a man that I've had to a conference. But then we have other elements of that group that, you know, aren't particularly helpful. And we have the organisation putting forward some claims about speeds of aircraft recently. Now, I just wouldn't mind getting a perspective from someone that's not directly involved in that argument. You know that I've done some work on the impossible speed claims, and I basically think that the claims that the speeds were impossible are baseless, you know, based on my own research and practical, you know, doing a test in the simulator. Now, what's your view on that sort of information that people are putting forward? Basically, a theory about the planes not being the real planes without any real evidence, but simply, you know, postulating based on, you know, some academic sort of point of view on things. Do you think that's very valuable?
Well, I think, as you point out, this is an area where we have to look at just very solid practical knowledge and not go off onto what I like to call exotic theories. The thing with the impossible speed is that it has been used to support the no planes hit the towers theory, which has got to be, in my opinion, probably the most destructive theory that's ever come along in 9 years in the 9/11 truth movement, just because it sounds so crazy right on the face when you've got literally thousands, probably tens of thousands of eyewitnesses that saw and or heard the planes approach and or hit the towers. And so it's a, like you say, very potentially destructive, and I think in fact destructive theory. And that's what the impossible speed has been, seems like, to me anyway, one of the main things it's been used to support is the idea that no planes hit the towers. But if you even separate that super controversy away from just the simple question, well, you know, is it possible for planes to go that fast at near sea level, those particular planes, in terms of power, in terms of the drag on the plane, in terms of the just the physics of it, just the pure physics. The first thing that immediately comes to mind for me is, well, it happened.
That's it.
I mean, the planes did hit the towers. Their speed was measured within a few miles an hour. Therefore, it happened. So therefore, it can't be impossible because it happened. So I think in very practical terms that way. That's just part of how my mind works. But apart from that, you have the kinds of information, and I particularly am very much in admiration of the work that you've done, John, in terms of running a simulator test, which I think is very solid evidence and very solid science that says, yes, not only could those planes do that speed at that altitude, they had both the power and the structural integrity to do so, but they could actually do more than that. They could actually exceed the maximum speeds estimates for either of the two planes. But
the thing is, I don't say that I know that for sure, do I? I'm reasonable about it. And I say, well, you know, maybe the planes were modified. We don't know. You know, there's a whole lot of things that could happen on 9/11, but there's one thing that we suffer from in this movement continuously that leads us down these paths to marginalization, and that is we simply don't have the data. If I could get, you know, I've read all the reports from all the wind tunnel testing that was done on the 767, and, you know, I've looked at all this material. They tell us nothing. You know, all these military, you know, laboratories and military testing facilities and Boeing and all these other companies that are tied in with the government, they won't give us a shred of evidence, of real evidence or information about anything. They won't tell us when the aircraft will break up. They won't tell us what the Mach effects are in transitional speed. They won't tell us any of the information that we need to actually figure out whether it's possible or not. We just can't get hold of the data. So without the data, just like the Pentagon, without the data, we can't come up to any hard and fast conclusions with what happened on 9/11. And I don't understand why people can't understand that. We don't have to know what happened. That's not our job as a 9/11 truth movement.
Yeah, exactly. And again, to fall back on just simple common sense, I mean, the planes were observed to go that speed. So therefore, whether they're modified or not, they went that speed. It's kind of end of story. You know, it's not really that complicated when you get down to really simple practical information that anybody could understand. Yeah, those of us with engineering degrees can get more into the technicalities and wish we had more data and so forth. But the basic data of the videos that were able to be used to time the planes and to get the exact velocity, you know, we have that. And it says, okay, the planes were going, you know, X hundreds of miles an hour, and that's what happened. And it's just beyond that, it gets very speculative, and we get beyond, we get into these endless arguments of trying to figure out what happened rather than let's just stick to what we know, which is certain things didn't happen or couldn't have happened any other way. You know, those buildings could not have fallen the way they did other than controlled demolition. That's just really basic, and it's provable.
That's it. And statements from pilots saying that the plane couldn't make that speed are ludicrous because they've never tried to make the speed. So how can they comment? You know,
right.
It's ridiculous that someone would say it's impossible when they simply cannot know. And that's how you should judge people.
They can't know.
You have to judge people.
Right.
By,
yeah.
Their reasonableness. You know, people like Richard Gage don't say things are impossible or possible unless he can really prove it, you know, and he actually shies away from stating anything it's fact or not. Obviously, you know, you can state that 2.25 seconds of pure freefall with Building 7 is impossible without removing the structure because no one is prepared to argue with him about that, you know, because that is
right.
Something that you can state. But besides things like that,
right.
We really don't know. Anyway, we're going to go to a brief break now and we'll get back to some really interesting topics after the break, and I'd like to thank Ken Jenkins for being with us today, and Visibility 9/11 will be back after this short break.
We the people raising the roof. Got power sleep. I've been blessed with the vision of the power in me. I see a movement. Can you picture it?
follow me and using your voice, let's make it happen. Take heed to my political rap, and I'm on a mission to acquire all the knowledge I'm lacking.
Architect Richard Gage is a member of the prestigious American Institute of Architects. Mr. Gage has founded Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, a nonprofit organization comprised of hundreds of accredited professionals who are demanding a real investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. We asked Mr. Gage why he and nearly 600 of his colleagues are calling for this new investigation of the events of September 11th, 2001.
The evidence compiled by the National Institute for Standards and Technology and FEMA has left out the most crucial evidence found at the crime scene. This forensic evidence includes smoking guns that lead all 562 architects and engineers to realize that these buildings were brought down by explosive-controlled demolitions.
Many Americans are still unaware that there were actually three steel-framed high-rise buildings that collapsed at the World Trade Center on September 11th. The third high-rise was the 47-story Solomon Brothers building, also known as World Trade Center 7. Even though it was not hit by an airplane, it came down in just 6.5 seconds at near free fall speed in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. But there are many more issues that Mr. Gage and his fellow architects and engineers are concerned about.
We have sounds of explosions and flashes of light heard by 118 first responders as the towers came down in a symmetrical and nearly free-fall speed through the path of what was the greatest resistance. This doesn't happen in buildings. Why are we missing 90,000 tons of concrete at the base of the building? We're looking for a stack of floors. That's 110 floors, each an acre in size, missing. Actually pulverized to a fine dust, landing all over Manhattan. Why do we have tons of molten metal found by the first responders and iron workers and structural engineers and other officials at the base of all three World Trade Center high-rises? Why does the pulverized concrete and the molten iron and the ends of the steel beams carry the chemical signature of thermite, a high-tech incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter? This is actually documented by FEMA and left out of the final report by NIST. These are among many of the problems left out of the final report that the hundreds of architects and engineers signed on to our petition, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, are wrestling with and therefore demanding a new investigation.
In light of this compelling scientific evidence and the many unanswered questions, we asked Mr. Gage what concerned citizens can do to help.
We're asking every one of you listening today to help us. How can you do that? Go to the website, look at the evidence, become familiar with it, and send the link, ae911truth.org, to every architect and engineer that you can find and everybody else that you know. This is a grassroots movement that's spreading by word of mouth, and the only change that will come and the only possibility of a real investigation that we have is if everybody takes action. And you can give DVDs to architects and engineers and others. You can call them, you can email them, you can mail them. There is no limit to the creativity that each of you are called to in this extraordinary effort to make everyone in this country aware of the exact nature of the crimes committed. Go to the website, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Ask serious questions and demand answers of our officials. Let's get to the bottom of what really happened to these buildings on 9/11 and help us demand and obtain a real investigation. Let's raise the banner of truth, and we need every one of you to join us at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and encourage every citizen in this country to break the psychological barriers against knowing the truth about 9/11. I mean, what are you going to do? We're giving you a choice today, and the choice is to act, and the action will be guided by your conscience. So please join those of us who are moved by our conscience to do something for truth today. Thank you.
Visit ae911truth.org. Discover the latest information and then take action. Send the links, send the DVDs, and share the truth with every architect and engineer you can find. You can make a difference.
For a boot in your face.
Life and Truth Movement with Ken Jenkins today. If you don't know who Ken Jenkins is, you can just get on the net and Google him. You'll find him and a very interesting article that he wrote for 911truth.org called The Truth Is Not Enough. You can find that at 911truth.org and many other places around the web. Anyway, Ken, just moving on now, we've had a really interesting discussion that first part. I'm really quite enjoying this. I like to look at the movement on this podcast. That's one of the reasons I was interested in becoming the host while Michael was having a rest and getting up to some other things. Because I really think we need to talk about what it is we're doing and what's being successful and what not, and getting people like yourself that have a history in the movement that's seen a lot happen, getting your view on you know, the way it is and the way forward. Anyway, the next question I had to ask you was about some very controversial recent assertions made by a man called Dr. Alan Sabrowski, and he's basically, you know, said that 9/11 was carried out by Mossad in Israel, and he's 100% certain. He's also said that if the American people find out, they'll wipe Israel off the map, and they should do that. In his view, that's what he said anyway in his interview with The Ugly Truth. Now, many people have tried to say that, you know, 9/11 was a Jewish conspiracy. People have said it was Mossad. They've said it was Israel. They've said it was the neoconservatives, you know, with help from Israel, or they've said it was the military-industrial complex. I know other people have said it was you know, the City of London with help from Saudi Arabia. Other people have said it was the banks. It was the New World Order. It was the Bilderbergs. It was the CFR, and maybe even the Trilateral Commission, possibly. So there's a lot of people making claims out there about who did 9/11. You know, Ken, you've been around. You're the guy that's looking into this all the time. You've got the psychological aspects in your head about how these sort of things work. Who did 9/11, Ken?
I like the way you put that, John. Answers, I don't know. Yeah, these questions, we can't avoid them. They're always going to be there, and they're fun to play with, and they're fun to muse about and try to figure out, you know, what might have happened and who might have done it. Many people see great value beyond just the interest, that's part of our sort of job or duty or our role as 9/11 activists, is to be able to answer those questions. And I don't agree with that. I think our job is to raise questions in people's heads that dispute the official story and that say the official story simply can't be true. Not that it isn't true, it can't be true. And that in doing so, we open the door to people in doing their own investigations and finding out what really went on. And eventually, as we are successful, which I think we will be, maybe say a little more about that in a minute, but the who did it part will, of course, follow. It inevitably will follow that as we establish the fact that the official story is wrong, therefore it wasn't done by 19 guys and with box cutters and a laptop in a cave or whatever the official story is, and open it up to, well, who of all these other suspects you name and a bunch even beyond that that weren't named could have been involved, might have been involved, and perhaps were involved, that will follow as we get closer to having a real investigation with subpoena power, with a budget, and when we have eventually real legal grounds that can ask those important questions of who actually did it, because we want to answer those questions, and of course many people want these people at the very least taken out of power. And some people want a lot more. They want them in jail and so forth. And this is all very reasonable. But what's not reasonable is to expect us to know who did it, or to put the emphasis on that as if that's our primary role. And I personally don't think so. I think our role is to get people to think about alternatives and to eventually and as soon as possible demand a new investigation that's truly independent and that answers the hundreds of questions that have been raised by not only the movement, but of course the families of the surviving families and so forth, that put forth the questions to the 9/11 Commission that simply weren't answered. The great vast majority of the questions asked by the widows were not answered by the 9/11 Commission, and that's where we can put our demands and be very reasonable about it. There's nothing unreasonable about asking that questions be answered, and that's what I think what we need to focus on. The question of who did it, as intriguing as it is, needs to be more of our sort of, in my opinion, needs to be more of our sort of backroom discussions and our talk amongst ourselves. And I don't have a problem with people putting out a list of suspects. In fact, that's been done at several websites. I think one's Who Did It, which has over 100 names. And, you know, as I look at that website and that list, most of it seems pretty reasonable to me. But what is also true about a lot of the people on those kinds of lists is that there's some reason to put them on the list, rather other than that they're part of the global elite, they're part of this group or that group. For instance, if you say, well, gee, Larry Silverstein, you know, he's involved this and this way, therefore he should be on the list of suspects. Well, that's reasonable. But when you just throw out a vague accusation, oh, this person used to be the Secretary of Defense decades ago, and then they end up on the list, well, that's really stretching it. And I think we need to keep to the more solid, reasonable kinds of accusations if we're going to go there at all. And but also, as I say, not to make it our primary focus and not to make it some sort of thing that we have to do in order to succeed. No, what we have to do is get the general public demanding a real investigation by showing them the solid evidence that we have.
Eu queria ser mais do que um sinal horário das 23 horas. Queria ser profissional, passar uma hora mais tardia. Ser como a Pantera Negra, um maestro.
Um maestro não, um sinal horário pontual e com garra.
Perguntam-nos o que temos em comum. Uma frequência de 107.9, onde encontras pessoas que nem imaginas que existem.
Primeiro jogo de pré-época, Rio Ave 0, Aves 0. Foram para mim surpresas as presenças de Felício e Veslam como médios mais interiores na primeira parte.